From startup to global success, welcome to a special two-part podcast lifting the lid on small businesses in the creative industries. This podcast is sponsored by UPS.
Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Small Business Network. In this two-part series, we'll be looking at small businesses within the creative industry who've managed to spread their wings by exporting to new markets abroad. In recent years, the creative industries have been a huge success story, delivering over £17.9 billion in exports in 2013 alone, which works out at around 8.7% of all UK exports. And they're attracting so much attention that David Cameron has actually pledged to double the value of creative industry exports by 2020 to £31 billion. So it's obviously a great moment to be a small business owner in this industry, which is why today we're going to be showing you how to make the most of what's on offer at home to increase your business abroad. Later on in the podcast, we'll be talking to one of the small businesses that has started to have success in overseas markets. But first, to answer the question of why creative businesses have such a big opportunity to make inroads abroad, I'm joined by Carlos Grande, editor of the website The Creative Industries, which is a partnership between government and industry created to provide an international trade audience with a single overview and useful resources to the UK's unique creative landscapes. So, Carlos, what are the subsectors that make up the creative industries and what sort of business names might we have heard of?
So in terms of the sectors, we're looking at fashion, music, design, games, technology, i.e. the creative aspect of technology, music, arts and culture, publishing, architecture. So any sector that includes a kind of creative idea that can be turned into a business. And at the moment, those are booming internationally because Britain has an interesting brand that combines generally heritage skills, traditional skills, with something more edgy and sort of streetwise and kind of innovative. And that's pretty much true of all sectors. And the kind of business that we're talking about here would be something like Stage One, which is a company in New York, which was responsible for making the cauldron that was used in the London Olympic Games. So they've recently created the international pavilion at the Expo in Milan, which was voted the top pavilion out of all the countries. And they're also involved in events and stadia in Qatar and Baku and places like this. So they're actually, from a very small company, they've become quite an international business already. And another one for a domestic object is Merlin Glass. And they make these beautiful glass doorknobs that have attracted interest. I actually saw them on a stand at the Shanghai Festival of Creativity, and there were lots of Chinese buyers who were interested.
And that's quite a wide remit that you've got there, a huge bunch of different industries that we may not actually put next to one another. And do you think that these creative industries have always been this important to the British economy, or is it something that's been happening gradually?
I think the awareness of it has been more gradual. They've certainly been their kind of long-standing success story that perhaps you could say the UK hasn't actually shouted loud enough about. But the reason why they've become more important is because these are very high-value jobs. They're the kind of jobs that are difficult to outsource to sort of low-cost economies. They're very profitable, potentially, and they're very high growth. That part of the economy is growing much faster, both in terms of the kind of GDP factor and in terms of the number of jobs created than the rest of the economy. So when you've got a government that's trying to balance out different sectors, particularly after the kind of financial sort of meltdown and place more importance outside the financial services sector, then you can see why creative industries would be an important sort of make weight to other parts of the economy.
And you're talking about sort of the UK's brand and reputation. Do you think that we have a strong reputation for certain kinds of creative industries like music or fashion, for instance?
Yes, it's definitely been true. I mean, if you look at global music sales, it was last year the UK had 5 of the top-selling albums. Now is a very opportune moment because you can see that Adele is creating this huge sort of moment, you know, both on this side of the Atlantic and in the US. So those sectors have always been particularly strong. But it's interesting that technology is something that you wouldn't have associated the UK with, say, 10 years ago. But it's now pretty widely accepted that the UK is, say, the app capital of Europe. It's the place where the most interesting and potentially profitable apps are coming out of the economy.
Mm. It's curious also with the tech industry that it's something that we don't necessarily conceive of as being creative, but actually there's a huge desire to get more creators into it because we need the innovation, and that's often the place where it comes from. So how do you think that some of these SMEs can actually capitalise on this trend?
Well, it's very important that SMEs do think about it at the export market because there are lots of opportunities there. And You can see that whenever you go to a trade fair, that there's normally an interest in the UK stand, you know, whichever companies are on there. But I suppose I would say that it's very important to think about which markets are right for your business and to think about what you can actually do export-wise, because it's kind of a common mistake that companies of any size might rush into exporting when they're not actually ready. You know, they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have the skills, they don't often have the time to do it. So it's important to pick, you know, which of your products are most suited to overseas markets. And then I would say, look at what you can do in a kind of low-cost way, particularly now. I mean, look at your website, for instance. One of the things you could do if you're a small company is take advantage of there's a low-cost service that UK Trade and Investment provides, or they'll come in and look at your website and see how it might suit an overseas audience, and you might change some of the language you use in it, some of the pricing terms, the way that you describe your products. Very simple changes people can make to their websites that will make them more attractive to overseas buyers. So you can start in a very sort of low-key way, with a few changes in that direction, and then sort of build from that about, you know, where are the sales coming from, and then start to research the markets that might make sense for your business.
Wonderful, thank you. And for anyone listening who is considering exporting some of their services or products overseas, what would you say are three top tips of things that they can do right now to help them start on that journey?
We'll definitely look at your website, because I think, you know, even if you don't have any people on the ground in these markets, people will be coming to you, and you want to make sure you're not deterring people. Secondly, I would say look at the free resources that are available on people like the UK Trade and Investment website. You can download quite a lot of information from there, and why spend the money when you can get stuff for free? And the third thing is, if you're a member of a trade association, I would talk to them, because it's quite often the case that they do trade missions where they take a bunch of small businesses to a big trade fair or a conference. And again, you're not only getting the advantage of someone else doing all the kind of logistics and organisation, but you're networking with a group of similar sized businesses. So it's a way to make contacts and share advice. And again, it's a fairly low cost and low risk way of exploring an overseas market.
Before people kind of get too excited, which is, you know, one of the nice things that we're able to do is kind of get stuck in and see what other people have done before us. But to give people a heads up as to some of the challenges that they might encounter so we can better be prepared, what are the biggest ones that the creative sector might face in terms of remaining, for instance, competitive?
Well, I think protection of IP is always key if you're a creative business. So the intellectual property that your business is reliant on, you have to be able to be confident that you have, you know, trademarked that, and you have the kind of protection in, you know, as many markets as you can possibly do that in. And interesting, going back to what I was saying about free tools again, there's a free guide you can download from the IPR website, which is designed for all SMEs across Europe who are looking at the Chinese market. And obviously the Chinese market is a market where historically intellectual property protection has been a big issue. So I would start with those kinds of things. And, you know, that's generally a risk. And if you can make sure you have the maximum intellectual property, then at least you've laid the groundwork, even for the markets where you're not, you know, currently trading.
Brilliant. Thank you. Those are really wonderful, concrete examples of things that people can do. So here with us in the studio is also a company that has seen these opportunities and capitalised on them. We're joined by Andrew Lang, the director of a company called Cyclock, and they design beautiful and simple storage solutions for living with bikes in your home and in your office. And they're really gorgeously designed. They also won FX Magazine's Product of the Year awards. So welcome, Andrew. Can you tell us a little bit about your company, its structure and what it does?
Well, initially, I was solving my own problem, to be perfectly honest. You know, bikes are great things to get around a town and city, but they really do become a significant point of friction when you're not actually using them. I had a look around at what was out there on the market, and being a cyclist, you end up with multiple bikes. One is never enough. And what was available was generally pretty ugly agricultural contraptions, not something you would want to necessarily have in the living room of your house or your hallway. Cyclock is it's spun out of an industrial design practice based in London, and we have a family of products. We've now got five products in the range in a number of colourways, and it's a little family of products for living with bicycles when you're not actually riding them.
Great. So why did you decide to start exporting abroad?
Well, it's one of these things I hadn't really necessarily anticipated exporting from the outset. But as soon as you create a website, you're dealing with an international market from the outset. And if people want what you have, they'll pull it from you. It's really that simple. If you've got a product that is relevant to others, they'll make it known and they'll do everything they can to get it from you, even if you're not necessarily ready to start selling internationally.
And so what kind of help was available to you when you realised that there was this kind of demand being made of your products abroad?
Well, the very first retailer to adopt our products was a chap that ran a shop in Soho in New York. So, and that set the tone. And pretty early on, we had opened up Germany and a good part of Europe and broke into the US market. But in terms of actually help and guidance, in terms of how best to marshal that that approach, UKTI has been a great asset from the outset.
So what are some of the other things that have helped you, and what makes your product stand out, do you think, on this global stage?
Well, I think that ultimately we've ended up creating something that's unique and more so relevant to people that ride bicycles today. And there's been a great upsurge in the number of people that are riding bikes, not just in the UK, but that's actually happening across North America and Europe and such like. But we've got a situation whereby people have identified the need that our product presents. They may adopt a bike into their life, and then pretty soon they realise that it creates a whole set of problems when it comes to living with one. Well, dealing with an international market from the outset, you end up receiving a lot of feedback from customers that have perhaps bought your first range of products. And for instance, I'd mentioned New York being a case in point, and we hadn't visited any New York apartments or such like prior to launching our first product. We were ostensibly designing for a UK-based customer. But having discovered just how small New York apartments are, and that information ended up informing design decisions that we made with the second product that we launched, Endo, where we ended up developing a product for storing bikes vertically, just because the actual envelope that a bike takes up in one orientation can be quite different to another.
So, Andrew, you mentioned that one of the businesses that had picked up some of your products was actually based out of Soho, New York. Do you know how they found out about you to begin with?
It's quite a curious situation. And we'd done a few trade fairs. We'd done one here in the UK, and then we took a trip across to Milan and exhibited there. And my understanding is that a couple of American blog sites picked up on it. And it transpired that this chap that had the retail space in Soho was a large arbiter of taste in North America. Then there was certainly a tipping point when a couple of blogs announced the launch of our first product, and certainly the hits on our site went stratospheric. So they never underestimate the power of blogs. I hadn't really appreciated just what a vehicle they were until that point.
So maybe finding people, wittingly or unwittingly, who are going to advocate your product and then get the word out there to the people who are really interested.
Indeed, indeed. Early adopters that can shout and talk aloud, that are as passionate about what you're doing as you are yourself, does go a long way.
So when we're going back to looking at export, what kind of difference has being able to export your products made to your business?
I would say that the vast majority of our products, I would say between 75 and 80% are exported. So our core income is from international markets. And the success of customers adopting products internationally obviously generates a revenue stream that comes back into the company. And all of that allows you to then reinvest in the capital outlay for new injection mold tooling or whatever else it is that ultimately you're manufacturing your products from. So you end up with a situation whereby you are closing the loop, and you may well be feeding the machine, but ultimately what you are doing is expanding your range and generating products that your customer base is looking for.
Okay, and if you could go back and do it all again, what's a piece of advice that you'd give people of something that you would have done differently?
Perhaps be selective. It was mentioned earlier that you should have the infrastructure in place, and that's definitely something that we didn't necessarily have in the first case. I did mention that our products were largely being pulled from us, and to be honest, that's still often the case. We don't do a great deal of upstream active promotion. People become aware of them and set about getting hold of them. And that's quite heartening. It's nice when people want to adopt something you've created into their lives and make it theirs. But it is a problem nonetheless, ensuring you can actually satisfy a demand that has been created.
And so what might be an example of that, for instance, on websites? Is an example maybe taking payments from various different currency?
Yeah, and having a a sales and payment portal on the website is fundamental. And okay, we deal with tangible objects and we're not so much a service provider. And it's always much easier when you're selling an item. It's a very simple exchange. But one thing that you should perhaps be aware of if you want to break into a market is where you want to enter that market. And do you want to deal with distributors? Do you want to deal with key accounts? Or are you dealing with more of a contract market where perhaps what you're selling is a capital good rather than a consumer item? And certainly with our products, we're doing all of those.
And so for someone who's listening to this thinking, oh my God, I don't know where to start, how do I possibly figure out which of those options to go for first? What kind of advice would you give them in terms of actionable things that they can do?
I would think you really have to stand back and understand what your business is currently and where you think it's actually going to go next over whatever period of time you want to allot to that, and ensure that you've got the framework in place with that end objective in mind, not necessarily where you're at the moment, but where you want to be.
Okay, great. So to both of you then as creatives, do you think that there are lots of entrepreneurs who are very skilled at what they do but actually need to pick up business skills along the way to help them with things like exporting and structuring their business and visioning where their goals are going to be in 5 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, if you look at the statistics, most businesses in the creative sectors are micro businesses, so fewer than five employees. And in some sectors like the craft sector, you know, almost 90% are sole traders, and they've gone into that discipline because they have a passion for what they do, whether it's weaving or jewellery or basket making, whatever it is, but they're not necessarily business people. So they obviously have to talk the language of business when they're talking to finance people to get funding and to continue to get funding. But in many cases, they have to find the right people who are their business partners, which can be quite difficult if you're used to working as a sole trader. So I think I don't know how you feel, but I mean, I always think it's about what makes you passionate. If what makes you passionate is the product, then bring in someone else to do the finance who maybe, you know, feel passionate about that. But if you're very passionate about controlling the business or seeing it expand, then maybe you do want to retain some of the control over, you know, the kind of business aspect.
Absolutely. Just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should be doing it. If there's somebody out there that's better at a particular role than you are, let them do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I found previous to this current role, I worked in a small business that was a very international business. It was an online information service, so it was almost from day one practically global. We found that a lot of things happened just by luck. So we would think about, we'd do a lot of research and think, oh yes, India is our next market. And then the Singapore development people would come and knock on our door and say, actually, if you open an office in Singapore, we'll do all this for you. So quite often, I think if people research some of the more kind of proactive markets, like Singapore, I think, they can find that a lot of the kind of business infrastructure is almost in place for a startup. You can just walk in and they'll help you with, you know, tax structures and all that kind of stuff that you wouldn't normally take on yourself.
Fantastic. So I'm going to ask about something a little bit different now, because you talked a little bit about service and infrastructure. But in terms of the types of products that are being exported, perhaps the question for you, Andrew, sometimes very delicate items can be worth a lot of money. How can companies ensure that they get them safely from A to B without incurring hidden, you know, customs fees and all the rest of it?
Well, it's one of these things. It can be quite tricky. And also, it depends on whether you're actually supplying wholesale volumes of product to a distributor in another country or whether you're actually just doing direct sales to an end user. Packaging is one thing that does incur an enormous on-cost, particularly if you're dealing with something that's volumetrically quite large. With our first product, it is a fair physical size, and shipping it from one country in the world to another can be quite a significant on-cost. And we actively designed further products which were physically much smaller, just so that we could actually ensure that we were shipping things as efficiently as possible.
Well, so needs must. So are there any final words of wisdom that you'd give before we wrap this up?
I would say that if you're relying on subcontractors, whether it's creating printed matter or whether they're actually casting items or injection moulding items for them, make sure that they really understand the picture that you have in your mind as to where you're going and that they're fully behind you.
And I would say just stay true to your sort of creative passion, because yes, you should do everything to make it easy for people outside the UK to buy from you in terms of facilitating your website and the way that you work. But actually what people are buying is a product and a vision, and Brand Britain has a lot of appeal at the moment. precisely because of the kind of idiosyncratic, innovative qualities of a lot of creative product. So don't be tempted to dilute your product for overseas markets, because actually I don't get a sense that's what people are buying. I think they're buying really the kind of the genuine product.
And also the brand of where it's from.
Yeah, very much so.
Wonderful. Thank you, guys. Well, it's clear that there are plenty of ways to embark on exporting and as a result to start growing our businesses. So thank you very much both to Carlos and to Andrew for your advice and first-hand experiences. And join us for the next and final instalment of this podcast for the Small Business Network, where we'll be looking more in depth into the practical steps for exporting. Thanks for joining us and see you next time.